got Downer and Randy Nose on this train wreck today, and they are jizzing over BBSs. This all started off because I mentioned Jason Scott to Randy here, and he, had to explain who he was, and as soon as I did, he remembered, and was like, yeah, he had, information of mine up there, but it was wrong. And it kicked off a discussion about Edison Star and the history of it. You want to run down the quick history of Edison Star?
Sure. Edison Star, well, early on, back in the, late 80s? Yeah, I ran a bulletin board. One of my first computers was a Tandy, and I ran Searchlight. And I had a bulletin board called Edison's Workshop running Searchlight BBS. And I'm a big fan of Edison. And the bulletin board metamorphosized from running Searchlight into running PC board. From another sysop who didn't want to keep running the system, and I changed the name to Edison Star because his bulletin board was called CalStar. And so just to kind of signify the merging of the two. But we, I pretty much, I used to run different doors. That was part of the challenge of running the bulletin board for me because the way the BBS is ran.
Let me ask a question before you get too much in there. How did you get into running a BBS?
Oh, good Lord. I found out you could do it, and I found out that there was, I guess basically because I had a computer that had a 1.44 floppy, and that was enough room to run Searchlight on it. And I just started running the bulletin board off the 1.44 floppy. It was 720, and because there's people that had Cocos or Commodores that were, much smaller disks, but that was enough room to start the BBS and the message spaces until I got a hard drive later on. But I don't know, it was just something curious to do, something I figured I found out that I could do, and I started doing it, and I enjoyed it. I did it for almost going on 5 to 6 years from start to finish.
Now, what software did you... You said you ran Searchlight. That was the core of your BBS?
Right. SLBBS. Searchlight BBS was what I started off with. And what was unique about Searchlight at the time was that it allowed full ANSI editing for anyone that had an IBM or IBM emulator in the terminal. So you could actually cursor back up to the top of the paragraph if you had 3 or 4 lines in there and fix your spelling. They weren't so... The BBS didn't have spell checkers built in them. The user therein could check the screen if they had something, some of those utilities, but there weren't... there wasn't a whole lot out there at that point in time, not like today as far as it was all plain, 80 column text and screen. Was it 80 columns by
80 by 25, I think? Was it 40?
No, it was 80 by 40, I think, is the standard screen, if I remember right, which there's 40 columns wide, but that was for like Commodores. Those were the old Ataris. Those were 40 columns, whereas IBM's the standard 80 columns. And so, yeah, there's also going in 80-column mode or 40-column mode when you're reading or writing to the BBS, the way it formatted the text.
So if I'm understanding part of what you're saying there, back in that time, Searchlight was kind of unique in that you could, scroll back and edit things, whereas other ones you might have to go back, just delete everything to where you wanted to fix it and start over.
Sure, yeah, like control, you had to use control characters. Once you got done with it, your 80 columns or 40 columns, once you hit enter on that line was there. And so if you want to go back and edit, it was really hard to do that for on IBM, say, if you're using an IBM on a Commodore BBS, you still have to go back and edit it the old way, and the Commodores were stuck to text mode on the IBMs unless they had an ANSI emulator or the Atari emulators. And early on, it was pretty much just straight text. You hit return, carriage return, that was there, so unless you deleted the message and started over. And all this is at 300 baud or 1200 baud, which waiting for the screen to re-scroll and refresh was very painful sometimes.
Now, Downer, you also ran a BBS at one point, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I had run a modified Renegade and stuff. I got into it kind of late, actually. Hold on one second. Hello. It's Medical Blizzard. I got a package for you. Gated communities. Yeah, when I got into it, and I wasn't really a message board BBS either. I was a file BBS. So it was a little bit different, but cool at the same time, I guess. The scene was completely different by the time I got there. And when I first got into it, I was just a random user for a long time. And then I was just like, you know what, I'm gonna play with this. And I decided to put a couple of my own up. Over time, I did like two or three different ones. As you kind of get involved in different scenes, because at that time, you know, there was an art scene, and then there was like a literature scene where you're writing, you're sharing like more like e-zines. And then there was always, you know, your wares, your pirate boards. I got into that too.
Randy, we glossed over this. You said you ran a two-node BBS. Is that correct?
Well, when I was done with it, yeah, it was two nodes. I was mainly, I had a few shareware, freeware files, but it was mainly for messaging. I was involved with two different message networks, and, you know, users are fairly more verified also. I wanted to point out that the anonymity Internet wasn't quite as much, because you knew who your users were, or you verified them, so you had a little bit better information. You know, if you got an email with an attachment, you knew where it came from. But, I had two nodes. You could actually go into chat mode if two people were on there. If I was there, three of us could get in there and chat at the same time.
Now, do you remember, like, the most unique location you ever got a call into your BBS from?
The most unique rotation?
Where, like, the most unique phone number you ever saw pop up, like Australia or something like that?
Oh, no, because I wasn't really a large board, because with the way the networks was, I was more or less a sub-node, and so I had a sub-node, I was a node off the network. You know, because the main network for both of our message spaces, I was running this on the West Coast in California, and we exchanged my computer in the middle of the night. We'd call up a friend of mine's computer, who lived, say, 200 miles away or an hour away, to exchange messages in the middle of the night because the rates were cheaper then. And his computer would call up the main system in... I'm just going to use Intellicus for a reference because I don't recall the other one. But his was called the main system that had about 300 other computers calling into it total. And usually it was a tier of about 4 or 5 computers off of that. So say the main one had 10 guys calling in there, and there was, say, 10 off of that and maybe 5 little subnodes. But if you exchange messages twice a night or twice a day, you could get your email delivered usually within 48 hours, 24, depending on when someone, you know, sent and received their email.
And people bitch now that it takes an hour to get an email sometimes.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was still faster than the U.S. Postal Service, but no one, there weren't that many people that were doing it, you know, doing email. You know, we're talking, I was doing email. Other people that did email thought about it as AOL or CompuServe, because those were the big main systems that existed that in that era.
And Downer, how many node did you run?
I was only ever one.
Now, is there like a most unique phone number that sticks out? Because from my understanding, the file share stuff was a lot different than just your messaging ones.
Yeah, well, you have to think generally in a Wares board. You don't really want to share it too much unless you're comfortable with people. So, unique numbers weren't really common, you know? I mean, that's at the point where, you know, just in order to get on the board, you needed a password often. You know, I had a new user password, so if you wanted to go in and you just randomly happened upon the BBS name and phone number, you would still have to know someone on the board in order to get in. You would need that new user password just to accept the application process. And then, on top of that, a lot of the time, you know, because all the people are also, like, you know, aware of the community, there was also a new user voting, where if you apply, you know, you still have 3 or 4 days before you can be approved because the users have to approve you.
Now, did you also have a, I guess the best way I could describe it at this point is using the torrent analogy of a seed rate?
A what?
Where you had to upload so much before you could download it. So much.
I didn't take part in that, but a lot of boards did. Yeah, they forced sharing.
Now
I would just let it go for free.
Now, how did most boards work that in the time?
How did
from your experience at least?
It depends. I mean, you can configure it however you want. You can have it file for file, where you know, especially at the time, it was okay because. If you do it by, like, K, by how much K you're uploading, kilobytes, you're gonna get screwed at some point. Because then, especially on a single-node board, you want to dull it down by file for file. If you upload an e-zine, you know, you can download one file of anything else. You see that happen often just because that one node is going to be tied up for a long time if you're downloading a good program. You know?
Are you using the normal dial-up phones to do this, Downer, and modems?
Oh, yeah. This is at the time I would have started a BBS, would have been 14.4, and eventually graduated to 28.8, and then by the time 56K rolled around, man, that shit was all over.
Right.
Everybody was. That was by that time, you know, everybody's using Linux and you know, maybe a couple of TeleGuard boards popped up every here and there, but everybody was pretty much done dealing with anything because BBS has started to die out.
Oh, yeah. Well, my users wanted to get online and do email, and, you know, the Internet got big, and I was doing mine for free and not had a computer tied up for 5 years. I was hitting burnout, and, you know, I was a free board, but I accepted donations. I got maybe $14 a year in donations average.
Nice.
50. So it was a hobby, and it was a learning experience for me. And I was kind of happy to be able to turn it off at the time because everyone was, you know, the Internet was out there, and people wanted access to stuff that I didn't have access to anymore. Or easy access without paying for it.
Yeah.
And yeah, if having a pirate board or a porn board, which we had plenty of those back in the 80s and 90s too, those were the ones that were paid for. People would basically, you'd have sysops that would scan porn pages or porn magazines and put up 50 new images a day. And so people were spending money on the porn. Porn was still big on the computer, and it's just as strong then as it is today.
So
oh,
even
yeah.
Before the Internet, the telephones were for porn.
Oh, absolutely. I wanted, my ex-wife and I had a lengthy discussion that I lost, which probably was a good thing, because I wanted, because I knew it was just off that I was pulling down $600 a day or a month running his BBS. He was making a profit running his BBS because he had porn on it. I said, well, shoot, I could do this if I just put this porn on here. We don't want that, you know. We don't, you're not going to do that. And so it was made clear to me that I didn't want to do that. So I didn't. You know, had I been single, I probably would have. But my ex-wife, so in some respects, the stuff that I was involved with, there's two different styles of BBSs. Mine was more of the squeaky cleaner one, which, you know, even us were hypocrites, but that's how it looked and felt when you got there. But not to say I didn't have pirated software, I didn't ever have a porn file, you know. But the BBS was squeaky clean for the church folk, I guess.
You kept it as clean as you could, at least.
Yeah, well, you know, if there's message areas, you know, profanity wasn't around in most of the message bases, because for me, our verification was my computer would call someone's phone number right back. I used a utility that would verify a phone number, and that would go with that username. And if someone wanted more than one account, say there was a family, they would, you know, they would have to send me a message, and I'd have to upgrade the other user. But that's how we verified who people were. And the message areas that I used
would you explain the verification process that you used? Because you said you had a utility that would call the user right back, but what would happen from there?
When they called up to register their name, they'd have to put in a phone number, and my computer would hang up on them and call them right back, and the terminal would come up and type in, hello or some sort of message right there, or just, you know, make sure it got a connection with another modem immediately, and then it would upgrade them to a minimal level, and I could upgrade it to a little bit higher level for time. Basically, it was just time and certain message areas. Because being a message BBS, you know, they tried to keep everything clean and everything verified. So the information we got for online was a little bit better. The way people treat each other was a little bit more, was some more respect. Because if you wanted to stick around, you had to adhere to some, you know, common rules of decency, I guess. And which, you know, we get in chat mode now, and someone could just start going nuts, and IRC, and you can't boot them all the time.
Yeah. Callback verification was cool. The only problem is you run into that problem where if they live in Australia, you're going to get charged for that call, especially at that time. You know,
Right,
full call at that point, you know?
Well, you wouldn't. I would allow it to call outside of the U.S. We had a list of, you know, area codes that were allowed, or there's a list. And if the area code wasn't there or out of the country, you could leave the SysOp a message. And you know, if you talked to them via the message boards, you knew who they were, because you could still send. I could still send a private message from my computer and through the network, end up as a private message on someone's computer in Australia.
Yeah.
Now, if someone became a problem user, how the hell would you get rid of them? Did you just have a deny list that would deny calls from a certain number? Or?
Yeah, you could do that. You would deny them. If someone really wanted to be a pain in the butt, first, you try to leave them a private message, so that'd be the first way of dealing with it. And if they continue to misbehave, you just cut them off. And say there's four or five other message areas or bulletin boards, say, in your local area, they could still call on to one of those and get on and try to cause problems that way, but eventually they'd wear out their welcome and just they would be not denied until they had a different phone number to use.
Now, did you ever collaborate with other sysops that they call you up and say, look, we've got this one user who's a real problem. You should probably just cut him out now and save yourself the grief, or would you?
No, you had to wait. Basically, we didn't do any kind of blacklisting like that. You might get a call and say, be careful, this person caused a problem for me, you know, and I kicked them off.
But see, well, part of my message, you could also set up access levels where, you know, if somebody was a problem in the message board, you know, harassment for instance, then you know, you just go and deny them access just to the message boards. And if there's still a problem, you can deal with it appropriately as it goes.
Right.
So
there's
to handle it.
Now, do you remember the name of the application you used for verification if anyone was interested in it?
Me? No, I don't. No, some BBSs probably start building some of that in there. It was one of the different call door utilities, because towards the end I was running PC, so it was a door that was compatible with PC board, and that's off the top of my head, that's all I can come up with. I mean, we're talking, what, 15 years ago? almost 20 years ago for me?
Yeah, for some of our listeners, that'll be a time before they even were, you know, existed.
Well, I realize that, yeah. Well, hey,
Oh, you got to be kidding.
Hey, Downer, how did you verify users, or did you even mess with that the password?
Well, you'd have the password, and, you know, generally I never really had any problems. I mean, you generally know everybody who's going to be on the board at some point. And, I mean, by the time I got into it, it was such a popular thing. You know, that was when the internet was, like, just budding, and, like, there was a local board in the area that started out. I remember
it was
four notes.
Mid to late 90s?
Early 90s, even. You know, 89, 90, 91. At that point, there was a BBS that was one or two nodes at first. It later jumped up into four, and this was a pirate board. This had a lot of, you know, you go on there, you get your porn, you get your pirated software, all that kind of good stuff. And then all of a sudden later on, this board turned into 10 nodes, 15 nodes, 25 nodes, 40 nodes, 50 nodes, and all of a sudden they had 250 lines, and we're providing internet for the whole community. Turned it into a whole business.
So what started out as a pirate BBS board became a local ISP?
Yeah, basically.
Well, that's where
TCP access, and it became a big thing, and I believe they're still in business.
Well, and that's how one of my friends who was a sysop that did the porn back where I lived in Redding, in California, he started off with the porn. He was making $200 to $300 a month to $600 a month off the BBS, so he had the money to reinvest into the hardware, and he did, and he started an ISP.
All right, guys, we've added Avi to the call.
Who's here?
Hello.
Ready?
What's going on?
We've been talking about BBSs to do for an episode of HPR. So.
Wait, what?
All right. Exit 223. I'm at exit 241. I got about another 10 miles.
Do you have any last thoughts you want to say on BBSs, man?
Me?
I don't have anything.
Well, I've got one last question for both of you. Have either of you run into the Ghost Town BBSs?
The what?
What I've heard it called, where, you know, people will track down these old numbers for BBSs and call them up and find out these things are still running even today. But no one's accessed them in, like, 5 years plus.
Oh, yeah. I think if you watch the BBS documentary from Jason Scott, there was a guy that talked about running a BBS, and it was still running in someone's basement a couple years later. Everybody had forgotten about it.
What is his BBS?
Excuse me?
Hey, either one of you gentlemen want to explain a BBS for Avi?
I'll let Randy do it because I'm making a delivery.
A BBS is basically back in the day, you used your computer with a modem, and your computer dialed up instead of used the modem as a phone line, dialed into another computer, and you communicated basically with text. It was the old way of doing, the old school way of communicating with a computer.
It was a precursor to DARPA's, you know, network that later became the internet.
Right. Well, the internet has existed long before I ran my bulletin board, but yeah, it wasn't accessible by the general public. Mine was a free BBS that connected other computers. Let's see, Rhyme had about 500 or 600 computers hooked up to its network, and Intellic had about 300 for message, and those were just message areas. And you could talk about, you talk about batch files and programming, BASIC, bicycling. There was a bunch of different topics and message boards. For me, a lot of it was just learning how to use the computer and different programs. Part of it was having shareware or freeware online to download for the non-pirate boards, and the pirate boards, anything was available there.
All right.
That's real easy, right?
But it's interesting to look back that, you know, I knew someone who had a porn board, and they ran it, they turned into an ISP because they had the money to invest into it. And Downer was talking about that, and I was, you know, I wanted to start up an ISP back then, but I didn't have the money.
Yeah. Too much money.
I wanted to invest the money in it, and my spouse thought it was crazy because I already spent $10,000 or so over 5 years on a computer, and this is just another crazy idea that Randy had that wasn't going to go anywhere. And I said, no, this is the one idea. So, anyway.
All right, guys. Well, I think this will make a pretty good episode as it is, so I'm going to jump off of here, and I'll talk to you both soon again.
Bye.
Bye, Lord Drock and Blue. You have a good one. I gotta hop off here and do the real thing and do the work thing. So.
All right.
True.
I'll catch you later, too, Downer.
All right, man. Take it easy.
Later.
All right.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Hack Republic Radio. HPR is sponsored by Caro.net, so head on over to caro.net for all your hosting needs.